Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. Our guest this hour writes that teachers frequently emphasize the importance of English above all else when they speak with immigrant parents, and many non-native English-speaking parents are told not to speak to their children in the language they know best, depriving them of their richest source of social, emotional, and linguistic support. The reality is that these parents who sign up their kids for dual language, and there are many of them, are onto something. They recognize what many teachers, principals, and policymakers do not: knowing two or more languages puts you at an advantage. We're going to talk about that issue this hour of the program with Professor Rebecca Callahan, Professor of Bilingual Bicultural Education at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm sure that some of you have either learned another language or several other languages, or feel that English is fine. I always wish I could speak more than one language fluently, and imagine it would open up a world of possibilities, to say nothing of new people who speak other languages. But the truth is that only 1 in 4 Americans is conversant in another language, and bilingual education is controversial in this country, and parents speaking their native language at home is somewhat controversial as well. So we're going to be talking about all the related issues this hour. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Rebecca is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Rebecca Callahan, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Yeah, our great pleasure. So it's true that only 1 in 4 Americans speaks another language. I'll bet if you go to Europe, that number is what, 1 in every 2 or at least 1 in every 3?
At least, yes. But other countries have greater histories of bilingualism, of multilingualism, of simply closer contact to other languages than we do here in the U.S.
What is the current research telling us about the benefits of being bilingual, maybe benefits that we never even thought of before?
Well, what's interesting is the cognitive and academic benefits are actually several decades old. We've had wonderful research about the benefits of bilingualism to problem solving. Basically, when you're bilingual, you have two coding systems in your brain. And it allows you to see different ways. Every item, every concept has a life in one language and in your second language or third or fourth as well. So as a bilingual or as a multilingual, you approach the world with at least these two different coding systems. And so we've seen this cognitive advantage for bilinguals. We've also seen a social advantage in terms of developing empathy, having a greater understanding of how another might approach a problem or any given situation. Bilinguals often don't just speak two languages, but they negotiate two cultures and two different ways of being.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that social empathy. And most recently, we've started with newer data sets and with a newer job market as well. We're seeing a marketplace advantage where we have not always seen it using traditional census data, where employers' markets are no longer a physical 15 or 50-mile radius, but rather a global market, and having bicultural employees who can negotiate with a greater proportion of their clients is a huge advantage.
And every now and then, as you remind us, we are reminded how important it is that we speak other languages, and how after September 11, we needed Arabic speakers and Farsi speakers, and we simply didn't have the number of people we needed, right? So these big things happen, and we think, oh, I wish we spoke more languages.
Right, and the sad thing is we have this incredible linguistic resource as a nation. We are, in so many ways, a nation of children of immigrant parents. And these children have this resource. They have their parents' language in the home. And it's something we could foster. Even if our teachers in our schools don't speak that language, there are ways that we can support the parents maintaining that as best they can with their children in the home. And when parents speak to the child in their home language, in their first language, the child learns the emotional nuances of the language, how to express emotion, how to maintain ties, how to be strong and connected to your family. And we know that, we pretty much know that going to school in the U.S., going grocery shopping in the U.S., going to the bank in the U.S., the entire world outside of the home is going to be in English. Children of immigrant parents will learn English. Mm-hmm. The greater challenge is actually making sure they can maintain and even develop that home language.
Are there really many non-native English-speaking parents who are told not to speak to their children in the language they know best? Who tells them that?
Anecdotally, my grandparents were told not to speak Italian to my mother and her siblings. We still hear it today that, my family's case, the priest came from the church. Different churches, of course, are very different, and some really grasp on to and recognize the importance of these maintaining family ties and family unity, and that the home language is a way to do that. But teachers and administrators will mistakenly recommend that parents only speak English to the children with the hopes that this will help test scores. There's maintaining a language other than English in the home is a little bit counterintuitive, because one might think that the fastest way to learn English would be by speaking only English. But if you're a child growing up here, the fastest and most effective way to learn English is actually through the language that you already have established. And by learning to read and write in that language, you can do that more quickly and translate those skills over into English later on. Go ahead.
I was just wondering how we, and I'm sure this varies from state to state, but there are some school districts who, in a very foresighted fashion, decided that if you are a native Spanish speaker or if you're a native English speaker, that you're in the same classroom and things are taught in Spanish and they're taught in English as well for both segments of the population, which appears to have done very well for test scores and for being able to become fluid in both languages.
Right.
Are those programs very rare, Rebecca, or are we seeing more and more school districts start them?
They used to be very rare, and since in the last 10 or 15 years, they have just begun to skyrocket. It is, I think, probably one of the fastest growing school programs, educational programs that we have going on right now are dual language or two-way immersion bilingual education programs. The schools and districts have seen that there's a real benefit to learning a second language or learning a foreign language for their native English speakers, and that dual language programs offer the potential of socially integrating both your immigrant, non-native English speaking or other than English speaking population and your native English speakers. So the idea behind dual language programs is that not just academically and cognitively are we going to be learning both these languages at the same time, but we're also going to learn the culture and share across one another. Of course, it takes a lot for teachers to be able to negotiate the different status of these languages, but it can be a very successful, very positive experience as well.
And do you think that there are certain languages, obviously the world has many, many different languages, are there certain languages that we would be more beneficial to us to learn than others?
Certainly. I think we have about 6,000 languages in the world right now. And
we have 6,000 languages?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding me.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
Yet, you probably want to target a language that's spoken by enough people. If you're thinking of learning a foreign language as an adult here in the U.S. or even thinking about what you want for your child, you want to learn a language that you can use. Of course, there are hundreds of different reasons for learning a language, and it may be that you really want to communicate with certain friends as a family, or you've gotten to know somebody and you'd love to know more about their culture. That can also be a motivating reason. There are language maintenance with our native indigenous populations. They've developed a number of language revitalization programs in the Southeast especially, but through different native communities. So we have these revitalization efforts. There are lots of reasons to learn another language. And anyone you learn will give you all the same benefits.
Yeah, I'm sure. And what about now? Do we have reliable Farsi, Arabic, Pashtun speakers?
I think it's growing. I know it was a struggle after 9/11 that became readily apparent that many of the children and many of the youth in these communities had lost the language in the process of going to school here in the U.S. So we are trying, I think, as a society to redevelop that and to make sure, to kind of spread the word that it's incredibly important for immigrant and foreign-born parents to maintain and develop that language with their children.
We welcome phone calls. All our lines are going, so let's go to phone calls. We're talking about the importance of bilingual education, the importance of learning a foreign language, and why it is that only one in four Americans can speak another language conversationally. Does it need to be higher than that? What are the benefits of our mental benefits, the benefits in terms of employment for being able to speak a second language, and should we be incorporating it in a much more substantial way in our schools in this country? Our guest is Professor Rebecca Callahan. She's a professor of bilingual, bicultural education at the University of Texas at Austin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And we start our calls with Linda in Lake Geneva. Hi, Linda.
Yes. Oh, hello there.
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
Yes, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, great.
Good.
Great. This is an exciting subject for me.
Good.
I have a lot of passion for having learned a second language as an adult. I learned Spanish as an adult. And I want to put in a plug for the advantages for having an exposure to a second language for non-native speakers early on, because I grew up in a very exceptional school system. And Wauwatosa, and they had a language program that probably was one of the few in the nation in the public schools that began a second language. The options were French or Spanish or German in the first grade and all through elementary school, and of course all through, you know, middle school and high school. For myself, I went through, I think, through the eighth grade with German, and German was my ancestral language. And so that laid the foundation, I think, for much more easily assimilating Spanish as an adult. And I went and lived in Mexico for an extended period of time after I finished college. And my husband was Mexican-American. Now, his parents, the mother never learned English. The father studied on his own and learned English very well. So he was a role model for both languages. But thanks to the mother always speaking to the children in English, in Spanish, that language was not lost. And then my first husband was able to go back to Mexico after I finished school. We both moved back there for about 3 years and lived in the interior, and he became more acculturated once again. And then I was able to, especially after 6 months, begin speaking Spanish and then ultimately becoming very fluent in Spanish as an adult.
Great.
So it's interesting that it does affect I think, you know, just having a strong, you know, foreign language program in the schools is really important. Now, my daughter, I just spoke Spanish to her until age 5 when I moved back to the States. And then I started just speaking English to her to get her prepared a little bit more for,
right,
for school. She spent extended time in Europe with her undergraduate degree in global studies and started out in Spain and relearned Spanish,
mm-hmm,
at age 20, became fluent pretty quickly after, mm-hmm, about 6 months. She was talking to me on the phone and very well, conversing very well in Spanish.
Yeah, that's great. Is it harder, though? We keep hearing, Professor Callahan, that it's harder as an adult to pick up some of these skills, and that's why we should learn it very young and while we're in school. Is that correct?
So Linda brings up, and this is a really interesting point, technically it is easier to learn a language as an adult because you already have literacy skills in your first.
Huh.
However, huge caveat, emotionally and psychologically, it is much, much easier as a child.
Hmm.
Because even if you're talking, and Linda, I think you said started in kinder or first grade.
Yes.
You haven't learned that you don't want to be different from everybody else. You don't want to stand out. You don't want to make an error. So when you start as a small child, you hear the language, you grasp the accent and the pronunciation in a way that we just don't as adults after we've passed through puberty. So what's very interesting is that we have a stronger cognitive skill set to learn that second language as an adult, but we've also learned that we don't want to be different, we don't want to make mistakes, we don't want to mess up, which holds us back in terms of using and practicing the language. And younger children don't have those social disadvantages, I would argue, but they also don't have the literacy skills, which really help with learning a second language or a foreign language. So if you already know how to read and write, and you know how syntax works, you know how to make things possessive in English, you know the structure of the language, those are pretty easy skills to transfer over to your next language. But you have to produce, and there's a social, emotional level to putting language out there that you just can't quantify.
Well, I remember somewhere in the deep recesses of my talk show mind years ago talking to somebody who said that after the first couple years of life, there are certain sounds, and I would imagine they would come from certain of those 6,000 languages, that we just can't reproduce anymore. If we're learning one language, we'll never be able to learn the sounds of some very unusual language because that pathway in our brains is closed off.
There is some research saying that our development of phonemic awareness, essentially, of hearing the phonemes of a language occurs with up to a certain age, with that plasticity in the brain. After a certain age, I'm sure there are exceptions. There are people who are incredibly musically or orally talented who would be able to produce and replicate those. But for the most part, that's why you hear heavy accents among adults who've learned their second or foreign languages.
I see.
In young adulthood or in older adulthood. So that they may have great syntax, they may have wonderful grammar, their fluidity is there, but they have a thick accent. Henry Kissinger is probably a great example of that.
He sure
incredible
is.
Incredible vocabulary.
Right.
He has a smidge of an accent, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, I guess
I don't know if you've ever noticed. Maybe not.
Yeah, I noticed.
It's slight.
Right, it's just a little one. We welcome more phone calls for our guest in a minute. Our guest is Professor Rebecca Callahan, Professor of Bilingual Bicultural Education at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about the benefits of bilingual education, and there are many. Test scores are better. We have better problem-solving skills. Social networks are better. Getting a job. And that's true if you think about the number of applications you've seen. Do you know a second language? Tends to be on many of those. It's it's all in all a good thing. So how do we accomplish it? 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page where we like to go after the show, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Tim in Milwaukee. Hey, Tim. Oh, Tim, bad phone. Hello, Tim, call us back. We just can't hear you. And I know what you have to say is important, but we're getting the road sound. And just that's all we're getting is the road sound. Ruth in Madison, hi.
Hi, I love this topic. I'm going to have a really hard time limiting myself here. I grew up as an English speaker, but my mother's parents spoke Bohemian as their native tongue. And so I think I heard different sounds in their accents and things like that. But I studied German in high school, and I studied American Sign Language after high school. So as a union steward, I could represent the deaf employees. And now I work in a Spanish immersion daycare and preschool, and I'm only a substitute. And so as I'm learning Spanish, I have toddler-level Spanish. But I think it's good because then as the Spanish-speaking teachers can correct me, and then the kids can watch somebody being corrected and then how I say it again, and then they might correct me yet again, because sometimes the P's and the B's, you know, like I learned the word for hay is Baja. Now, is that B-A-H-A like the Baja Peninsula or P-A-H-A? I mean, it's P-A-H-A. So you have to know the difference between these very subtle P's and B sounds, but then the kids can watch me being corrected. And I think a lot of times the parents worry when they drop their kids off at something like a Spanish immersion school that the kid isn't going to know what they're doing. They're going to wander around and not understand anything. But we do help them, and we understand. And I use sign language along with. So, like, I might be telling them, "Mamas y papas siempre vienen," and "Mommies and papis, mamas and daddies always come." But I'm also signing, "Mamas and daddies always come," when I'm doing it in English and in Spanish. And sometimes we see around age three, the kids will, like, go silent and kind of not want to speak in the Spanish, yet we will encourage them to say it in Spanish, and then we'll answer them in Spanish. And then after, like, sometime around age four, they just chatter away like they've been speaking it their whole lives. It's just kind of awesome. And I think it's such an awesome thing to have the young kids learn another language really young. Mm-hmm. I think it's very helpful to them.
Professor Callahan.
Yes.
What do you think? Oh. You're on.
I think it's she brings up a great point that when children are being raised bilingually, there will often be a period where they produce less and they're quiet and they get reserved for a while. But once they do start talking, they talk a lot more. And they have way more to say, and they're going to get their points across. But there is often this period, because they're processing, because they're integrating two distinct languages, where there's a little bit of a pause, a little bit of a hesitation. Things are coming out a little bit slower, but once you get over that initial hurdle, they are more likely to come out with complete sentences. They're more likely to, as Ruth says, they go on and on and on, and you can't stop them. It's a really neat process. When kids are growing up developing two languages, there are little ebbs and flows, but that they will become incredibly articulate in both because they've had to do this negotiation. So it's this incredible resource that we really should be taking advantage of if we can.
I like the idea of the children being able to see her being corrected. Mm-hmm. It's a switch of roles, isn't it? And it's probably a good thing for them to be observing.
Oh, I think it's a wonderful thing. And Ruth brought up a great point that she's kind of fumbling through it. She's got a early child level of proficiency, but she also brought up that adult literacy skills. So it's paja. Now, is that the pa de pantalones or the ba ballena? Mm. And she knows what words look like written.
Mm.
mm-hmm. as an adult. So she's making those extra connections. And mm-hmm. 2-, 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds don't have that necessarily yet, have that letter sound correspondence or the symbol sound correspondence that we have as adults. But having her as a role model really helps the kids understand that everybody learns languages, that it's not something all adults have. It's something that we all learn. We all learn second and third and fourth languages eventually.
So thank you so much, Ruth, for your call. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. I didn't learn, like one of your previous callers, I didn't learn a second language until I was in my middle 30s. I was teaching Rosebud Indian Reservation, and I took a course in Lakota language. And I think that's best thing that ever happened to me. I forgot most of it, but I can still count to about 20. But to be able to find a number, I've got to count up to it. I can't just pick out a number. I can't do that. It just won't work. But any time I've gotten into a different culture, the first thing I've always done is start asking them how you say certain things in their language. Mm-hmm. I start probing their language, and that gives you an in into the culture real quick.
Why is it that we forget languages if we don't use them, and how often do we have to use them to stay up to speed?
I think it's a lot like roller skating. I don't know about you. I did a lot of roller skating up till about age 15.
Right.
A lot of round and around the loop. We went last year, and it was very painful. it's not quite like riding a bike. But it is something you do need to practice. You do need to engage with others. And our caller, is it Kate?
Eugene. Eugene,
okay. Mm-hmm. Eugene, you brought up this connection, the cultural connection, but language and culture are very heavily intertwined, and it's about connections with other people. So language isn't just learning a set of vocabulary words that are off to the side somewhere. It's about learning how to express your wants, your needs, your responses, your feelings, your ideas. So using the language makes you part of that culture, but it also, it is something that you do have to use. You probably don't lose it entirely, but it does, you do get rusty.
Right. Thank you, Eugene, so much for your call. Kate is next in Holman. Hi, Kate.
Hello. First of all, I want to support everything you're saying, but I want to give you some balance to this. I'm a 40-year teacher. We have been trying in Wisconsin, and I think in many states across our country, to have second language programs introduced in the early years. We know what research says. We don't have money to do this. It's the first thing cut. And it is so sad because it goes against everything that research says. And particularly now in Wisconsin, there will be no money for this. And I listen to you and I support your speaker. I think she's also investigated some of this school funding. But it's a sad place to be because we don't have money to do what we know we should do to make our kids global. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Yes, it's incredibly frustrating. It is incredibly, incredibly frustrating, especially when the part of the cost of a bilingual program is not extra cost. It's simply a teacher who speaks both languages, and we're employing a teacher anyway. I'm not saying we're getting rid of one group of teachers to replace with another, but as more and more of our teachers and our teaching force becomes bilingual, hopefully that is something that can grow. But yes, it's right now most of our elementary second language and foreign language programs are additional teachers. So schools have to hire somebody else on top of the classroom teacher to go from classroom to classroom teaching that second or foreign language. So cost is a huge, huge issue. And it's something I will actually be speaking about this week later here in Austin, Texas.
Oh, you are? Who are you speaking to?
Just a group of teachers at a school here, mm-hmm. here in town. So, yes, this is very close to my heart. Kate brings up a very important point.
Thank you so much for your call, Kate. Jan in Shorewood, hi.
Hi. I don't want to give my whole biography. I'd rather focus on the advantages that becoming fully bilingual and bicultural have given me in my life. I'm now in my mid-50s, and I learned, began learning Spanish. I was a junior high school dropout of Spanish classes. I found them very stilted and boring. But then when I was 15, I met my best friend, happened to be someone who was raised throughout Latin America, and she was bilingual and bicultural. Then I met a couple of friends from Bolivia and Mexico, and I felt I needed to learn this language. So I went to Chile for a year, and after 2 months, I no longer had to translate. The brain goes through this transformation where you just understand and you just speak. And most of the words I've learned, I learned just through context, the way you do when you're a child. I worked really hard on my accent. My friends said I had a potato in my, sounded like a potato in my mouth. And so we worked to make the potato smaller, even by, you know, taping my voice and letting me hear it back, and then they would help me, and I asked them to correct me when I made grammatical or word mistakes, and so being open to that. But this is the magic of it. It's kind of like what happens with a lot of people in the Peace Corps. I felt like I became a baby again, and I was so immersed that I had to relearn a culture, and with that, the values, in particular, the interpersonal connection, and how that was different, and certain traditions, and of course, foods, which vary throughout Latin America. And when, at the end of the year, I felt like a foreigner in my own land when I came back.
Mm. Let's get a response. Professor.
That's, Jan, you bring up really important aspects of the cultural and the social process of learning and becoming, learning that second language, but more importantly, getting to know and become part of that other culture and learning a new way of being. And the culture shock that comes from traveling when you really study and live abroad does not necessarily go from going and finding how things are so different, but from coming back to your home and realizing all of the things we take for granted in every single interpersonal interaction and recognizing that how Americans interact just seems so... did to me, at least, when I first came back to the U.S., the first time I lived abroad, Americans just seemed so cold and so aloof and so loud. And it was just this my mother said that she doesn't want to ever have to be the one to pick me up at the airport again.
Where were you living, Rebecca?
I lived in Ecuador for a while. Yes, and it was a wonderful, amazing experience, but Jan said, you learn a different way of seeing the world. You learn a different way of being polite. You learn a different way of asking for things. You learn a different way of communicating your needs. And you become this other person in some aspects in this other language.
Yes.
And it's a really fascinating process.
Yes. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Owen in Green Bay next. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I need a little help. I'm first generation Haitian American, and I grew up speaking Creole, and like fluently, and speaking French at home. And when I was a baby, there was Spanish fluently speaking around me. And now I've married a beautiful, you know, American woman, and we have three kids. And my five-year-old has kind of chosen to speak English, I guess, because it's just easier. And I'm at a crossroads of just saying, at least I got good kids, or...
How far do you push this? I have a question. Is your five-year-old the oldest of the three?
He is the oldest.
Okay.
I have a two-year-old and a six-month-old.
And what about extended family? Are you around your parents, aunts, uncles, other Creole speakers, other French speakers?
I wish, because all Hispanics in my family are in Miami. Okay.
So it's just me. I don't want to say it's a lost cause because it's not, but you can enlist your wife to help on this. It is harder. You're right. It's much easier to just speak English because, especially that's what he hears you and his mom speak together. That's what he sees and hears in the outside world. But if you can even carve out certain times, certain places where it's just you one-on-one with him or you with the three kids, or does your wife speak any Creole? Has she learned some?
She speaks pretty well. She's still learning, though. And I guess she gets into a rut where it's easier for her to just say, hey, go open the door versus, ay, ube puerta. You know,
It is. We're laughing because we can identify, but there is a physical exhaustion that comes from producing this second or foreign language all the time, and you are tired.
Right. Yeah.
One of my colleagues really got what her ESL students were feeling when she did a Spanish immersion class for the summer and said, at the end of the day, I just wanted to put my head on the desk and sleep. Mm-hmm. If you can carve out, and I'm only offering because you asked, if you can carve out some either one-on-one or one-on-three times, or even just say to your wife, look, I know it's going to be hard, but let's just make Wednesday dinners or Saturdays in the park or some activity that you're doing together all in Creole. And this will be just, we'll make, and then increase it slowly. Maybe we'll start with half-hour segments and do a half an hour every afternoon and then increase it. And so it's just this kind of sacred space where this is a shared experience for your family. I don't know how much. It sounds like your five-year-old started speaking some Creole.
He did.
Okay.
So he'll try to pray in Creole, but it'll be the same exact prayer every single time. So it's like a memorization type of thing.
But that's a start, because that memorization, remember all the finger plays you learned as a kid, all the clapping games? That memorized language is a wonderful way to get going.
And it's wonderful that your wife speaks some Creole, too. It may be hard for her, but that's great that she does, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm really proud of her. She constantly amazed me, but she was raised in Okinawa, Japan, so.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And she's American, so pretty multicultural in our family.
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful family. Thank you. Thanks, Owen, so much for your call. And speaking of the exhaustion, Maria sends us, when you're trying to translate in, at the end of a day, Maria sends this observation on email. I'm a native speaker of Swedish, learned English as a second language beginning in grade 4. At the age of 22, I moved to the U.S. and had to speak English all the time. I clearly remember that my mouth and tongue were sore for several weeks while I got used to speaking English all the time.
Yeah, there's this huge physical element. That's a great way to, what a poetic.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's great.
Yes.
Thanks, Maria, very much for your call. And Owen, thanks so much for yours. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about bilingualism, the importance of it on many, many levels this hour of the program. Our guest is Professor Rebecca Callahan. She's a professor of bilingual bicultural education at the University of Texas at Austin. And over the past decade, her research has focused on the development of immigrant youth and how schools shape their experiences. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. We've had many of them on this topic, which is very nice. Our next caller is Matthew in St. Paul. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I learned Amharic, which is the national language of Ethiopia, starting about 15 years ago, and I speak fluently. Married an Ethiopian, and we have two daughters. And our oldest daughter is about two, almost three. And the question is, what do you do? Number one, it's not Spanish. It's completely, it's like, you know, you mentioned Arabic and Pashtun, which are just syntactically really different. So number one, like, overcoming those hurdles of just very different syntax. And number two, you know, when my daughter responds in English or when she insists on speaking English, at certain times of the day, because she realizes no other children, even there's very few children are learning Amharic in the U.S. So it's a question of, you know, we have that. I liked Owen's perspective, and I know a lot of people with Owen's perspective, but also the question of what do you do when both of you speak all the time in that language, and yet I don't know if it's rebellion or whatever it is. You have a child who doesn't want to speak it or only occasionally speaks it.
There will be resistance just because it is easier not to make the effort. As we've heard email, right? The person who or Maria who wrote in saying I physically felt my tongue and my mouth were exhausted. But if you do persevere, that you're, as parents, you're the first language policy makers your children will ever encounter, and there will be other language policy makers they'll encounter in life. But as parents, you are the first language policy makers, and it's very hard, and I hear you. This is something that I have struggled with, my friends have struggled with, family members have struggled with. But really persevering and holding the line, later on they will thank you. I kind of like, well, any of you played an instrument as a child and resented it as a child, but those of you who continued on and played because your parents insisted, most people I hear thank their parents in adulthood.
Yes, they sure do. When does it reach a point where it becomes effortless, where you can go from language to language and it doesn't hurt your mouth or your tongue or your brain?
So they say that for school, academic language, somewhere between 5 and 7 years in terms of understanding how to talk about photosynthesis and evaporation and square roots and the area, that kind of academic language, somewhere around 5 to 7 years. Mark, you're talking about a family situation, though, and yours are still relatively little. You said your oldest is 3 years old now? Is that what you said? So there will be an ebbing and a flowing. But during her early childhood, there will be times right now she's also probably testing other boundaries with you. And then she'll go into more Amharic with you. And as they get older, they become proud of this language, too, and grateful they have it. Then they'll hit adolescence, and there'll be a little eye-rolling. But it will also be a source of pride and a source of connection with you and any extended family. Is there any kind of an Ethiopian immigrant community around you, or is it just you, just your
family?
There
are. No, St. Paul is one of a very large Ethiopian population.
Okay, I thought
and we have friends. It just so happens that, you know,
most of them are not raising
because there's a whole generation of Ethiopians who didn't learn Amharic, who didn't, you know, and I guess a different topic, a similar, a related topic is needs. I feel like second language learning, wherever you are, if it's not getting your need, if it's not helping you to get your need, I feel like it's not a priority.
Mm-hmm. I see what he's saying with that. I'm sure a lot of people feel that way.
Right, especially because the payoffs are very long-term. They're not short-term payoffs.
Mm-hmm.
The cognitive payoffs, the social, the psychological payoffs tend to be across the years. Ellen Bialystok up at York University up in Canada has some great research out that points to the relationship between active bilingualism and a delay in the onset of dementia, which is wonderful, especially as we have an aging American population. But that's not something you've got a 3-year-old right now. And thinking about bilingualism and making sure she remains bilingual for something that could happen 70 years from now is a little bit hard.
Right.
But even on shorter terms, I mean, she will have the cognitive benefits as an adolescent, as a young adult. She'll have the cognitive and social benefits going into college and studying abroad. This will probably not be her only second language. This will be just the gateway language that makes Spanish super easy and French and all of these other languages she may choose as she goes off into the future.
Thanks, Matthew.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. We want to move quickly, if we can. We're running short on time, to a couple more calls. Bernice in Delavan, hi.
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 Yes. I want to comment on personal experience and how I see the big difference being exposed to a bilingual type of program early on and not being able to. My first language is Spanish, as is my husband, but and he was he grew up in California, where this type of programs are more prevalent. I grew up here in Walworth County in Wisconsin, when I went to school, actually they didn't have any type of, I don't think they had any bilingual teachers at all, so it was a little bit the big difference, and I see a huge difference in just his knowledge of the Spanish language and mine. And even the culture.
Yeah.
And I strongly support this type of program. I have our youngest child. She is in the dual language program, immersion program here in the Delavan Darien School District. This is the first year that the program has been implemented. And I was a part of a group of parents and community members that pushed through that program through for our community this past couple of years. And I already see her pronunciation just improving in both languages.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. We want to move to one more call. We're almost out of time. Benedita in Madison. Hi.
Hi. My only comment is quick. I grew up in Portugal, and I grew up bilingual in a German school and then learned French and English and Spanish.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
I am so really envious of you.
And my only contribution to this is that each new language adds a new soul to you. And there are concepts that only make sense in one language. So it just adds so much richness to your whole being, the way you perceive the world and the way you would talk about the world or express yourself about the world.
Oh, what a beautiful way to end the show.
What a wonderful,
isn't it?
Way to end. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Thank you so much for your call. Well, thank you, Rebecca. It was really an interest and so much enthusiasm for this topic. We were just flooded with phone calls.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Our pleasure. Adios.
Yes. Adios. Que le vaya bien.
Gracias. Rebecca Callahan. Oh, I wish I spoke Spanish fluently. She's a professor of bilingual bicultural education at the University of Texas at Austin. And we thank her so much for being with us. Tomorrow at this time, California and New York State appear to be the next states poised to allow for physician-assisted suicide. We will speak with the New York Times Retro Reports, Jill Rosenbaum-Meyer, about the history of the Right to Die movement. We hope you'll join us for that conversation tomorrow. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Jackie. And the first hour of tomorrow's show, we will be talking more about education. The Milwaukee School Board has invited three people who lived through or researched the recovery school districts that were established in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. They're in town this week, and they'll be with us tomorrow for a preview of how to improve low-performing schools. So that's coming up mañana. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks for all of your terrific calls. And we have news coming up from National Public Radio and great conversations ahead.